fragile, deceptively serene, just as it must have looked the day the Santiago first made orbit. From here there was no sign of war at all, until I saw the feather-like black trails of burning oil fields near the horizon. It was the first time I had ever seen such a view. I'd never been in space before now. "On finals for the Orvieto," reported the pilot called Pellegrino. Their main ship came up fast. It was as dark and massive as a sleeping volcano, a chiseled cone 4 kilometers long. A lighthugger, that was what Ultras called their ships, sleek engines of night, capable of slicing through the void at only the tiniest of fractions below the speed of light. It was hard not to be impressed. The mechanisms which made that ship fly were more advanced than almost anything I would ever have experienced on Sky's Edge, more advanced than almost anything I could imagine. To the Ultras, our planet must have seemed like some kind of experiment in social engineering, a time capsule, imperfectly preserving technologies and ideologies which were 3 or 4 centuries out of date. That was not all our own fault, of course. When the flotilla had left Mercury at the end of the 21st century, the technologies on board had been cutting edge. But the ships took a century and a half to crawl across space to Swan's system, during which time technology stampeded back around Sol, but remained locked in stasis aboard the flotilla. By the time we landed, other worlds had developed near-light space travel, making our entire journey look like some pathetic puritanical gesture of self-inflicted punishment. Eventually the fast ships arrived at Sky's Edge, their data caches pregnant with the technological templates that could have leapfrogged us into the present, had we wished. But by then we were at war. We knew what could be achieved, but we lacked the time or resources to duplicate what had been achieved elsewhere, or the planetary finances to buy off-the-shelf miracles from passing traders. The only occasions when we bought any new technologies was when they had some direct military application, and even then it almost bankrupted us. Instead, we fought centuries-long wars with infantry, tanks, jet fighters, chemical bombs, and crude nuclear devices, only very rarely graduating to such giddy heights as particle weapons or nanotech-inspired gadgetry. No wonder the Ultras had treated us with such ill-concealed contempt. We were savages compared to them, and the hardest thing of all was the fact that we knew it to be true. We docked inside the Orvieto. Inside, it was like a much larger version of the shuttle, all twisting pastel passages reeking of antiseptic purity. The Ultras had arranged gravity by spinning parts of their ship within the outer hull. It was slightly heavier than on Sky's Edge, but the effort was no worse than walking around with a heavy backpack. The Lighthugger was also a ramliner, a passenger-carrying vessel outfitted with thousands of reefer-sleep berths in her belly. Some people were already being brought aboard, wide-awake aristocrats, complaining loudly about the way they were being treated. The Ultras seemed not to care. The aristocrats must have paid well for the privilege of riding the Orvieto to wherever its next destination was, but to the Ultras they were still savages, just marginally cleaner and richer ones. We were shown to the captain. He sat on an enormous powered throne, suspended on an articulated boom, so that he could move throughout the bridge's vast three-dimensional space. Other senior crew were riding similar seats, but they carefully steered away from us when we entered, moving towards displays set into the walls which showed intricate schematics. Kaweya and I stood on a low-railed extensible catwalk which jutted halfway into the bridge.
"Mr. Kaweya!"